I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Early Friday morning, the 50-year-old Fern Hollow Bridge in Pittsburgh collapsed, taking cars and a bus down into a gully with it. Fortunately, no one was killed, but there were injuries and a lot of questions about why a bridge that had been in poor condition could be so neglected. The photos and videos of the scene are really quite shocking. It happened just a few hours before President Biden arrived for an already scheduled speech about the importance of infrastructure. The bridge is now closed and residents have to find another route in a city known for its bridges. The accident has raised a series of questions about the state of other bridges in Pennsylvania, and I'll talk with a representative from PennDOT in just a few minutes. But first up, Margaret Krause joins us. She is transportation and development reporter for WESA in Pittsburgh, has been covering the story. Margaret Krause, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Does anyone know why this bridge collapsed?
The reason for the bridge's collapse is now the subject of a federal investigation, and the National Transportation Safety Board, a bunch of officials on Saturday said in about 10 days they'll put out a preliminary report which will provide, quote, factual information, but why it collapsed is going to be probably 12 or 18 months away. But there are some indications that perhaps maintenance wasn't up to snuff on the bridge, even though it was having frequent inspections. And so it's impossible to say at the moment with any degree of certainty, but probably it looks like maintenance played a role.
Well, just a quick follow-up here, and I mentioned this in my introduction, this is just based on the reading that I did, is that the bridge had been considered in poor condition. Do I have that right, Margaret?
Yes, the bridge is considered in poor condition. There are more than 4,000 of those across Pennsylvania. And so poor is kind of a shorthand that PennDOT uses to basically prioritize all the work that needs to be done across the Commonwealth. So a bridge takes its overall rating of poor or fair or good from the weakest part or the part that's seen the most wear and tear in the bridge. And in this case, a lot of the structure was rated as a 6, which is not quite fair. And the superstructure, which is kind of underneath the direct surface of the road, was the part that was rated a 4 or a poor.
And bridges are made of component parts, and that's why they're these different grades, correct?
Yes, yes. And so during an inspection, each element is considered quite carefully, and there's a 558-page manual from PennDOT that tells an inspector who has to be nationally certified what they're looking for, what does that mean, you know, what kind of information do they need to then gather to see if further action is needed at the PennDOT level. It's a pretty darn complicated process.
Well, it certainly sounds that way. Do we know the condition of the motorists who were injured during this collapse?
I have not spoken directly with the people who were injured during the collapse, but my understanding from great reporting from my colleagues over at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette is that everyone is in stable condition, some of them in pain, as you might imagine, having been involved in this, but doing well.
How busy, I mean, this was early in the morning, and it's hard to imagine how much worse this could have been if this had been during rush hour. Help us understand this bridge, and this is a city of bridges, something like what, 450 bridges in Pittsburgh? Do I have that right?
Yeah, just shy of that, about 446.
There are 446 bridges in Pittsburgh.
Yes.
Okay, just to underscore that. Okay.
Yes, and so, you know, shortly after the collapse, there was a lot of talk on Twitter about how, well, I guess I'll just never cross a bridge again, which is a completely understandable sentiment. However, it's impossible to do that in Pittsburgh and in most places in Pennsylvania. You may not even know you're going over a bridge, but you are. So this is a four-lane bridge, and it's on one of the busiest state-owned roads in Pittsburgh called Forbes Avenue, and it connects a lot of different places. There's, you know, the sort of majority Jewish neighborhood called Squirrel Hill. There are a lot of majority Black neighborhoods that are also connected to downtown, and a very busy job center called Oakland through this road. It was often used as a shortcut from people getting off the highway, getting off 376 to kind of, you know, avoid that traffic going toward downtown and instead cut through neighborhoods. It was a bumping bridge, and it's true, so much of the reaction in the last few days has just been, thank goodness there was a 2-hour school delay for weather. Thank goodness it was early, and because even the NTSB said, the National Transportation Safety Board, that when you look at the scale of the damage, it takes your breath away.
Indeed. I mean, I think a lot of people have seen either the pictures or the video, and it does, I agree with you, Margaret, it does take your breath away, thinking, gosh, you know, I'm sorry that so many people were injured, but that no one died.
It's been called a miracle by a number of people I've talked with.
So how are people getting around Pittsburgh without this bridge?
Well, there's another main artery that can take people in the same direction that they would have used the Fern Hollow Bridge for. It's called Penn Avenue. And there's still the parkway, but as you know, I'm sure lots of your listeners know, hanging out on the highway is not the most fun. So there's going to be a lot of congestion. The city is trying to manage it by changing, you know, the traffic lights and trying to usher traffic along as much as they can. But it was a very busy road. And I think, and forgive me if I'm jumping ahead.
Sure.
I mean, a lot of how people are getting around is thinking about, well, this bridge was in poor condition. So many other of our bridges are in poor condition. And what does that mean for me and my daily life? And so I think it's pretty important to just hammer home that just because it's in poor condition, our PennDOT district executive out here, Cheryl Moon Sirianni, says that poor does not equate to unsafe. Right. And PennDOT officials will stress over and over that their main concern is safety and that they're very conservative. And that's partly why this collapse is so worrying to so many people is, okay, if poor doesn't equate to unsafe, then that's scary because this one did collapse and it was under scrutiny. And so I think it's this balancing act between being very clear that truly poor does not equate to unsafe. PennDOT officials are very concerned. There will be even more scrutiny now. And at the same time, there are a lot of questions to answer about how this happened.
Are there other bridges that are like the bridge that collapsed, the Fern Hollow Bridge, in the Pittsburgh area?
Yes, and there's actually two in the sort of Philadelphia area. They're called K-frame bridges, mm-hmm. which a professor of structural engineering at the University of Pittsburgh, Kent Harries, told me is a subset of something called a rigid frame structure, which is just the part underneath where the traffic goes, and then the supporting parts are all kind of welded together into one piece. And so there's one nearby in the city's Squirrel Hill neighborhood. There's one in Bethlehem, and then there's one in Philly, the McCollum Street Bridge. And so PennDOT has ordered a review of all of those bridges. And it's something called a non-redundant bridge, which just kind of sounds bad, but is not necessarily.
But it's not necessarily. And I'll be talking to a representative from PennDOT in about 10 minutes to deconstruct some of what you're saying here for us, Margaret Krause. What has been the response of city officials in Pittsburgh to this bridge collapse?
Oh, well, initially a lot of appreciation and gratitude that, as we talked about, that this did not happen at a different time with more people on it. There's already legislation been introduced to the city council that is going to do essentially a thorough review of our infrastructure and figuring out how to fund that and prioritize that. So, well, I'm sure we'll see that come to a vote pretty quickly. And in general, just our mayor has said his main focus, Mayor Ed Gainey, his main focus, and this was just his first month in office, will be to ensure that the infrastructure people rely on to live their lives doesn't require a second thought, doesn't require concern.
Well, as we know, the Biden administration has earmarked billions of dollars, not for Pennsylvania alone, but billions of dollars to update our infrastructure, including things like bridges. Does Pittsburgh know how much money they'll be getting from this pot of gold?
Sadly, a limited pot of gold. I think it's $1.6 billion for the whole state.
Exactly.
I do not know what amount is coming directly to the district that Pittsburgh is in at the moment. But even if that $1.6 billion for bridges were to be equally shared out, it still wouldn't be enough money. So it will continue to be a question of how do you prioritize what goes first?
Well, one of the things that we have learned recently is that the money from the gas tax that was supposed to go for infrastructure upgrades and repairs has been going, or not all of it, but a large sum of it has been going to the state police budget. Is that on
yes.
the table? Yeah. Yes, you say. And I know, Margaret, you've covered this, as have other people. What is the fate of that, do you think?
Well, Governor Tom Wolf has introduced a number of times a fee to municipalities to support state police that wouldn't come out of the motor license fund. Because a 2019 audit showed something like $4 billion was siphoned away from the motor license fund, which is supposed to go for infrastructure, roads and bridges, to the state police. So that suggestion that another fee be imposed to support the cost of the state police has just kind of stalled time and again. Initially, it was proposed just for municipalities that rely on state police, don't have their own forces, but then it was spread out to everybody. Harrisburg is facing a really tough combination of factors and has for some time, but it's coming to a head. In July, the Turnpike Commission will stop sending $400 million a year to PennDOT, and so they will have to find the money for that in the general fund or with a new fund. They have to figure out how to fund state police and create sustainable funding for our infrastructure and transportation.
So a lot of moving parts there. I'm assuming people are driving less. They're getting better mileage for their cars if they do drive. They might even have an electric car. So that has a huge impact on this kind of revenue.
It really does. And the governor had a revenue options committee put together this summer that issued other ways that the state could raise money for all these things we need money for. But there hasn't been a decision yet about which direction Pennsylvania's going to head.
And I'm just trying to absorb a city, and it is a city with almost 450 bridges. Is there any other city in the world that has that many bridges? Do you know?
Oh, superlatives are so scary to a reporter.
We're
often compared to Venice. Which is, you know, colloquially known as the city of bridges.
Right, right. So Pittsburgh might give them a run for their
money. We might be
up
there. Yeah.
So what else, about a minute before we have to say goodbye, so what will you be looking at as this story unfolds?
The funding picture is going to be so critical. It popped up already and will continue to be a focus. The money for the Fern Hollow Bridge has already been approved, and so has the authorization for engineering to begin, which is very unusual in Pennsylvania, and I'm sure the deputy secretary will talk about that. So the question is, it seems like work and funding for infrastructure can move quickly. It just usually doesn't. And so I'll be curious to see if there are any process changes to allow that money to flow more quickly. I think there will continue to be a push for the federal government to take a stronger role. They used to provide something like 70% of the money for infrastructure repairs. But I think funding, and also just truly trying to explain the nuance of what state our bridges are in and what that means for people and how the state and municipalities are trying to address the issues within their areas.
Well, Margaret Krause, thank you so much for getting our conversation started today in Radio Times. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And she is transportation and development reporter for WESA in Pittsburgh. We are talking about the state of Pennsylvania's bridges. Do stay with us. We've got another guest joining us after a very short break.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. A bridge over a ravine in Pittsburgh collapsed last Friday, just hours before President Biden's visit to the city to promote his infrastructure law passed last fall with bipartisan support. 10 people were injured, highlighting the critical need to repair Pennsylvania's bridges. The Commonwealth has some of the oldest bridges in the country. More than 3,000 are rated in poor condition. Joining us is PennDOT Deputy Secretary for Planning, Larry Shiflett. And Larry Shiflett, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Sure, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Should motorists in Pennsylvania fear crossing a bridge in the state?
Absolutely not. Certainly, we have as we're required by federal law, we have a very rigorous inspection program, whereas we're required to go out and inspect our 25,000-plus bridges at least every 2 years. If those bridges are, as much of the talk has been lately, in poor condition or determined to be in poor condition based on the most recent inspection and ratings, there may be a more frequent inspection that's needed. And sometimes it's annual, and depending on those inspections, it may even be more frequent. But again, just because a bridge is rated in poor condition does not mean that it is not safe for the public. If it would not be safe for the public, we would close the bridge if it was in that severe condition, or potentially wait post that for specific vehicles to no longer be able to go across.
Well, I think the language is confusing, and I appreciate the clarification. We also heard that from Margaret Krause, our reporter, about how bridges are described. And when something says poor, I think to the average person, you feel like poor is substandard.
Yeah, no question. And, you know, that is a label that certainly comes from USDOT. And if you look back just a few years ago, those that we now call poor condition were once called structurally deficient, which also wasn't, I'd say, the best term, and certainly creates a bit of doubt to the motoring public when they hear structurally deficient bridges. But again, poor condition does not mean that it's not safe for the public to utilize the bridge. And I'll just note that we've made pretty significant progress in Pennsylvania over since 2008. If you're looking at poor condition, what once was called structurally deficient bridges, again, we've reduced our number. I think in 2008 we were at about statewide over 6,000, a little over 6,000. Today we're roughly at about 2,400. So again, not to rest on our laurels or sure. to say we're, you know, doing everything we can, because we are doing everything we can. However, as the previous call had, there is a funding issue, and without adequate funding, we certainly can't address every bridge when we'd like to address every bridge. No question about that.
And I do want to get to the funding. Let me ask you, do you have enough inspectors? Do you have the inspectors with the kind of skills that you need to be able to inspect the state's bridges?
Yes, we're in great shape there. It really does come down to having sustainable, adequate funding to address not just bridges, but our roadways as well, because certainly you need good roads as well.
Sure. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg was in Pennsylvania last month. Pennsylvania is going to get something like $1.6 billion to fix our bridges. Larry Shiflett, is that enough money to do the job?
That is not enough money. You hear that number and you think, wow, $1.6 billion. But what I will say, if you look back to March of 2021, so not quite a year ago, Governor Wolf put forward a proclamation for formed the Transportation Revenue Options Commission,
right,
and challenged that commission between mid-March and the end of July of 2021 to come up with sustainable funding solutions, recommendations that would do a couple things. One, help to fulfill, we have a $9.35 billion annual unmet funding need. So
okay.
Just to put that in reference, $1.6 billion is what you mentioned, and that's spread out over 5 years. We have an unmet need of $9.35 billion annually for roads and bridges. So again, this will significantly help get to some things that we aren't able to get to prior to the passage of the bipartisan infrastructure law, but it certainly will not get to every bridge or every roadway that we currently need some work on.
Well, and I'm quickly doing the math, so that's about $7-8 billion shortfall. How will you prioritize if you don't have enough money? And clearly there is not enough money. How do you prioritize how to spend it?
Sure. That's a good question. And we have a really robust planning and programming process throughout Pennsylvania. We utilize our 23 metropolitan and rural planning organizations. Each of the federal dollars that comes to PennDOT, we pass through existing formulas and send to our, again, our 23 metropolitan and rural planning organizations throughout the Commonwealth. And then those are regional decisions to prioritize projects, both bridge, roadway, and as well as congestion management and safety projects. So when you start to divide $1.6 billion 23 different ways, certainly each of those 23 metropolitan and rural planning organizations has really hard decisions to make.
Sure.
Because of the inadequate funding for transportation infrastructure.
Do you have a timetable, or is it just too soon to tell when these projects get identified and then the money is spent and people are hired and you see the results?
Sure. A little early for projects identified, at least we have a process that we're currently undergoing. Every 2 years, as required by state law, we're required to update what's called our 12-year transportation program. So as part of that, we're, I'd say, two-thirds of the way through our current 12-year program update. And again, we lean heavily and rely very much so on those regional and local decision makers at the MPOs and the RPOs to pull together their recommended projects. That process requires them to go out for public comment. So again, we're, I'd say, two-thirds of the way. What you will likely see throughout the state, and since we're, I think, in the Philadelphia area right now,
we are.
I'll just say the Delaware Valley Regional Planning Commission is the metropolitan planning organization that covers the five southeastern counties in Pennsylvania. They do an exceptional job in working with each of the member counties to prioritize and pull together that list of projects for the 12-year program update. They do have a draft that they're working on list that will go out for public comment here, I'd say, in the next 2 to 3 months. Then once we get through that public comment period, again, this will happen in each of those 23 metropolitan and rural planning organizations. Once we get through that public comment period, address those public comments, they will officially submit their draft transportation improvement programs back to the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation, and we package all them up and submit them to our federal partners.
Wow.
Meaning Federal Highway Administration and the Federal Transit Administration, for them to officially review and take action on and approve, which should happen prior to or right on October 1st of this year, which is the start of a new federal fiscal year. And then also, as part of that process, our State Transportation Commission, in roughly the middle of August, will take action again to formally approve and adopt the 2023 12-year program. And again, that gets packaged up and submitted as well with what we submit to our federal partners.
Well, Larry Shiflett, I appreciate you joining us and taking us through this, what sounds like rather laborious process, but it's important to know, you know, how this works and how decisions are made about how to spend money. Thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Sure thing.
He is Deputy Secretary for Planning for PennDOT. Well, as I mentioned earlier in the hour, talk about timing, just hours before President Biden's visit to Pittsburgh last Friday to tout the importance of infrastructure, a 50-year-old bridge collapsed, injuring 10 people. Luckily, no one was killed, but the accident highlighted the critical need to fix and upgrade the country's infrastructure. Speaking in Pittsburgh, Biden promised to rebuild that bridge along with thousands of other bridges in Pennsylvania and across the country. A report card by the American Society of Civil Engineers found that 42% of bridges in the United States are more than 50 years old, and 8% of them, that's 45,000, are considered structurally deficient. Last November, Biden signed the $1.2 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill, so there is some money to address the problem. Joining us now is Adi Tomer, senior fellow at Brookings Metro, leading the Metropolitan Infrastructure Initiative. And Adi Tomer, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be with you, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And let me just make sure our listeners can join our conversation. Our guest is going to stay with us for the rest of the hour. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can pick up the phone and give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. We are talking about infrastructure, stuff that we use every day, and how to spend money wisely to improve and upgrade our infrastructure. Adi, let me go back to last Friday. And, you know, it's always sad when people get injured in an accident such as this. But this collapse of this bridge a couple of hours before the president arrived to talk about the importance of infrastructure, does that really focus the mind on the importance of this issue?
Yeah, you can't make up the timing, right, Marty?
You can't, no.
The tough thing in the infrastructure space is we all use it every day, right? You wake up, you know, one of the first things you do is you use a water pipe for something in your house. Eventually you're going to leave your home or apartment or wherever you may live to, whether it's to go to work, although these days a lot of folks are just doing different trips, and you use transportation. So this is systems we think about every day. And ideally, we don't actually think about them at all. So infrastructure makes kind of proverbial above the fold headlines when those systems don't work, and in particular, when they tragically don't work. So think about names like Harvey, Andrew, especially as a Floridian, for those who remember Hurricane Andrew, I-35 in Minneapolis, and that tragic collapse earlier in this now young century. So it is these tragic failures that you're exactly right, really focus our mind on just how valuable these physical systems are to allow us to do everything else we want to do throughout the day.
You mentioned Harvey, and I do want to ask you about the sort of crisis of climate change and its impact on infrastructure, and maybe infrastructure's impact on climate change as well, because if you have impervious services like a highway, you know, the water's going to run off and you're going to have problems managing water flow. But thinking of the numbers of storms that we've had in the last couple of years, the floods, the droughts, and the impact on our infrastructure system, is there a way to sort of understand the totality of that?
Yeah, there really is, Marty. And I'll give you a quick story example of it and then some kind of aggregate totals, because I think the planning director there spoke to it well. These numbers sound huge, but you've got to make them personalized, right, and connect to folks. So for folks who remember the freeze down in Texas, obviously for those of us who live further north, we're kind of better prepared for it. But when Texas froze over, well over 100 people died, massive amounts of economic damage. It would have cost $400 million to weatherize the entire Texas grid, which kind of sits separate from the rest of the country, to make sure basically those power outages wouldn't have happened. Right. Texas did not make that commitment to pay that money. They knew for a decade they needed to. Again, $400 million. During that time, the Texas Department of Transportation spent $2.8 billion expanding a freeway to the west of Houston. Now, every day, those Texas commuters were able to enjoy theoretically smoother flowing traffic because it's Houston. It actually became congested within a year of building it. So there's real questions on if they should have done the project at all. But think about the dimensions of that spending there. $400 million could have saved the whole state from all of that pain. But instead, we invested in a different kind of priority. That's part of the problem across the country. We have got to make really hard choices. And folks like PennDOT or local officials, and I agree, the Delaware Valley Regional Planning Commission is amazing. They're truly one of the best in the country. They have really hard choices to make. There's no black or white on this. But we've got to choose as people what's most important to us. And because we're building for the future, not just the present, when we execute these projects, what kind of future do we want us and our children to live in? We know that climate disasters are going up. So a final quick stat. In the 1980s, not that long ago, we had about $18 billion per year in damages from climate-related events. By the 2010s, it was up to $81 billion per year. And the 2020s are already showing that they're going to continue that upward trajectory. So we have got to get this under control to protect people, the planet, and make sure we can keep daily life more secure.
Well, is our infrastructure crumbling? I mean, there's so many different words, and even the idea of, you know, poor doesn't mean unsafe. But from your perspective, are we dealing with a crumbling infrastructure? And I think your example underscores the fact that we just don't invest in upgrading our infrastructure.
Yeah, this one's tricky, and I really you can't even imagine what that community feels like. You know, your colleague from the Pittsburgh radio station was just so powerful earlier. People are scared, right? I mean, it's the city of bridges. I mean, you've got to use these most parts of the day. Do you feel safe? Traveling. The reality is, as I think the planning director kind of spoke to, people should be confident. The vast, vast, vast majority of time, our infrastructure works. To give you an example, power outages across the country average less than half an hour on the year, right? Think about how frequently you flip that light switch and that power is on.
Half an hour on the year.
It's incredibly dependable. The amount of time that you have a water outage, and by the way, that's not for like a maintenance project down the street, where you get it, they announce it days in advance, hey, for these 4 hours, don't use your water, right? It's going to come out black if you do. It'll be fine, right, once we're done. The water outage is extremely low, right? You're likely to not have any water outages throughout the entire year at all in most communities, the vast majority when I say most. The problem is, again, back to where you and I started, when it doesn't work, it's almost like your entire daily approach crumbles around you, right? Your confidence and your trust in these systems you rely on, that none of us are engineers, so we don't know how they work, right? We just depend on them. So overall, I would say American infrastructure is not crumbling because you see what you do every day, meaning how often it works, but we are right on the precipice of needing to dramatically rebuild the systems that our parents and grandparents built for us. And that's really what this kind of federal infrastructure law, the commitments that states like Pennsylvania have been making for a few years now. We're at a stage now where rather than folks thinking, oh, this bill will last 5 years federally and we'll stop, we're probably at the beginning of what really needs to be a 15-year, I would roughly say, spending commitment to modernize these systems, elements like water pipes that we really depend on every day.
Yeah,
and at the same time,
gotta
invest
jump in
the future.
Okay,
too.
Fair enough. Sorry to do that. We have to take a very short break talking about infrastructure. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Mosco. And just to recap, a bridge collapsed in Pittsburgh last week, right before President Biden's arrival, to tout his plan to rebuild the nation's infrastructure, including bridges. We're talking with Adi Tomer. He's senior fellow at the Brookings Metro, leading the Metropolitan Infrastructure Initiative. We are talking about bridges and roads and water pipes and transportation and all the things that make up infrastructure, which is just about everything, including the grid. You can join our conversation. Any questions or comments, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Adi, you seem to be saying before the break that we are, I guess, living with and living on yesterday's infrastructure. Is that a fair analysis?
Yeah, totally fair. For the folks who are listening, driving around right now, just look at what you're using. These were built a generation in the past and they've really held up. But just like a roof on your house, you got to keep investing in it to make sure it continues to work.
Well, and I think, it's been a long time since I've been to Europe because of COVID. But nonetheless, I think for people that go to other countries, Japan, for example, and a number of countries in Europe, you see that their infrastructure seems so much better than ours. Now, I don't know, with a war where you have to sort of start from scratch, you get better infrastructure. But is there something we could learn from other countries?
Yeah, one of the big lessons is they spend more. We don't need to hide the ball from ourselves on that. The way we measure it is as the percentage of GDP, which itself is a pretty hard stat to even see into. But basically, the amount of stuff we make in the country, how much of it is that invested in infrastructure? And this new federal infrastructure law is going to take us up to about the same level we spent during the New Deal on infrastructure. So I'm putting aside Social Security and things, but think in your head, elements like the Hoover Dam, right? The Riverwalk in San Antonio. So it's a big investment program. But in the 1970s through the early 1980s, we were spending significantly more, almost double of where we're about to be.
Wow.
So we know in many of our lifetimes that America can spend more, especially at the federal level, on infrastructure. And that's a commitment places like Japan, Sweden, Germany have continued to make over time.
I mean, we have lobbyists. We're not talking about mom and pops who are building highways. I mean, why hasn't this been a bigger priority?
You know, it's really tough to unlock it. Where I sit, right, and I can only speak for myself on this, right? I mean, you know, senators, House members, whether, right, they're in, state capitals or in Washington, D.C., they have their own thoughts on this. But overall, I think we've struggled to adapt. What is our future vision for the country in terms of infrastructure? You gave a great example, Mario. If you go over to Japan, you're overwhelmed, which I've not been, but just seeing the pictures, right, of these high-speed trains connecting the country, the density of especially a truly mega city like Tokyo. How do they get this done?
Right.
But they have a commitment to many of their investments. South Korea has the fastest internet in the world because it's important for many of the companies that we actually buy products from here in the United States. And that's a good thing, right? LG, Kia, you know, et cetera. So what is the future of America look like? We need to have that discussion. This federal bill has started it, but those are answers that really, again, back to the mayorship in Philadelphia, in the surrounding counties, at the regional scale and right up into the state, they're going to have to answer for themselves. What does the future of life look like in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and across the country? And how do we make that possible?
Well, as clearly as much money is in this bill, it's not enough. And we've got everything from climate resilience, the bridges we've been talking about, broadband, transit, energy, transportation, lead pipes. It's a long list. From your perspective, you know, how do we prioritize where we get the best investment and where we get that return on spending this amount of money?
Yeah, this is truly the billion-dollar question here with this bill that I want to stress to everyone. Washington has now done their big work. The onus moves to Harrisburg, to Philadelphia, right, in like City Hall proverbially, to make decisions now. D.C. will not decide for you what to invest in. There's going to be huge amounts of money that have already hit the state. You've heard folks just on today's program talking about the committed bridge funding. There's also going to be competitive grants where you actually have to make applications to federal Washington, but they need you to apply, right? These are local ideas. So I would say this. For background, I actually, even though I work in D.C., prior to COVID, I've been living in Northeast Ohio, where my wife is from and we raise our kids. So a very similar, right, kind of, let's call it economic history and kind of current position, right, to many of the big communities in Pennsylvania. We are a slower growth place, right? And ideally, we would be bigger. But we need to think seriously, how do we make sure that we support the communities we've already built here in these states, in the specific communities, and leverage all of the assets we already have, make sure they continue to work? I have no problem saying this. I'm personally kind of troubled when I see us expanding, in particular, roadways in what are called green fields, or basically like what are former farm areas, right? While, especially in the snow belt, like we're both in, we have pothole strewn roads all over the place, right? That just doesn't make sense to me, right? Because all of us are going to have to pay more to maintain all those assets in the long run. How can we get strategic? The other bit really quick to say is we have got to make sure everyone is digitally connected, not just because of COVID, but that was the wake-up call we all needed. Everyone needs to have a broadband connection to their home. They need to have the available income to pay for a subscription, right? And they also need to have the skills to know how to use broadband connections, whether it's to make sure you can pay your taxes or to order some groceries to save yourself some time, right? So it is really important we get digitally connected, and not just in rural areas, but actually in urban neighborhoods as well that maybe have limited connections or just frankly, a low set of subscriptions.
So broadly speaking, the idea of sustainability, I mean, something that will take us deeper into the 21st century, and issues of inequalities. You say there are people that have broadband and there are many people who do not have broadband. Should those be the sort of driving philosophies?
Yeah, that's really where I kind of stand and our team does at Brookings Metro. And honestly, most communities do too. They recognize the climate urgency here because we're seeing it when these disasters strike, right? They cost a ton of money. Many of them are avoidable. And we're going to have to get serious about how we generate our energy and from where, how to make sure people can continue to work in the energy space. And obviously, this is a really important issue in states like Pennsylvania and Ohio. How we also, though, protect the natural environment we all share, whether that's upstream in terms of farming or even just the emissions from all of us driving around and the runoff from many of our roads, right, that get into our natural water system. So there's a lot of investment to be made there. And again, on the digital side, you know, we just talked about broadband. The other part I'll stress there is, you know, Pennsylvania is powered by industrial innovation, right? That's what so much built the modern economy of the state. To do that well, they need to make sure, again, both employers and the labor market or the workers have connections to the entire world in terms of the digital economy, have the assets to be able to make products that work with it, and then to modernize how we use it, right? I like to use the metaphor of aviation, right? Which folks may not think of as digital tech, but it absolutely is, right? And aviation makes the world smaller. It helps Philadelphia and Pittsburgh and other communities sell their goods and services all over the world and certainly the country. Broadband and digital connections is the same kind of thing, whether it's connecting you again to sales or even just making sure that you manage, you know, local roadways better and things of that nature.
We are talking with Adi Omer. He's senior fellow at Brookings Metro, leading the Metropolitan Infrastructure Initiative. And we are talking about how to upgrade, improve our infrastructure to meet the needs of the 21st century. Here's an email from Ronald. It goes back a couple of years, but he says, this show makes me recall several years ago when some PennDOT inspectors stopped in Port Richmond to get a sausage sandwich for lunch and spotted some marauding pillars underneath I-95, resulting in an immediate closure that lasted quite a while. Makes me wonder if those pillars are regularly inspected today. And I was talking to our PennDOT representative about, do we have enough inspectors to do the job? He says, yes. Do we, from your perspective, have the workforce and perhaps the skills to be able to make sure our infrastructure is up to speed, up to snuff?
Yeah, Ronald, thank you for the email, first of all. It's a great question. So we have 17.2 million people who work in infrastructure occupations across the country. That's about 10% of our workforce. So this is bigger than whole sectors like finance that we tend to think more about where folks are going to work. What's really great about these jobs is they have low barriers to entry, but they're actually high paying. So to kind of say it even more colloquially, you don't need a college degree to get these jobs, but you can have a lifetime career in them. The problem is this workforce is getting older. And just like states, again, like Pennsylvania, Ohio, where, again, the population overall is aging faster than other parts of the country, that's reflected in the workforce too. So the challenge out there is, how do we get a pipeline of talent going into places everywhere, again, from at the state level like PennDOT, into city maintenance, whether it's in Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, or smaller communities across the state? We have got to make sure that we get a diverse group into these, again, really attractive jobs. We've got 25% nationally of those 17.2 million people will need to be replaced in the next decade.
Really?
And we've got all this money pouring into infrastructure. So the work is going to be there. So if anyone's, you know, knows someone in your social network who's looking for a really good, durable job and doesn't want to go back to a college or even a community college, right, which are great too, but if they don't, that's not for them. Look into infrastructure occupations. They are really, really attractive, and you do really good work for society.
I was reading an article recently that a number of these infrastructure programs have actually been put on hold because Congress is still fighting about how to fund them. I mean, how does that delay what it is that we so critically need?
Yeah, so the urgency is going to hit no matter what. And what I mean by that, Marie, is the when the money comes to PennDOT, like it already is, they need to find workers, right? Whether that's directly employed by them or through the contractors who execute a lot of the projects. So the calls are going to be going out, and they're going to have to figure out how to train them. What we would like to see, and I say we, there's pretty universal position on this in the kind of workforce and infrastructure community, is for the federal government to come in and supplement what already happens at the local, state, and this is critical here, the private sector, who already does a ton of the training here. The federal government has really been behind the curve in terms of investing in workforce programs, particularly focused on the skilled trades and other infrastructure jobs. So there's a lot more that can be done. It is, I will say to folks, it is a big part of the Build Back Better program that folks have probably heard about that's sounding like it's now on the sidelines. If elements of move in that in a piecemeal way, I honestly believe infrastructure workforce is one of the more likely elements to get funded, either, again, individually or part of a smaller package.
Well, and just to underscore what you're saying, the federal government actually doesn't own most of our infrastructure, correct? It's really owned by state and local governments.
That's right. That's right. It's same way as that the federal government doesn't run many infrastructure programs. It's, you know, if you want to change, again, what the career opportunities are, or even just what places build, we just heard the plan director talk about. They're putting together lists right now. There are ways to directly engage. But the state, the community, they own these assets, or they're the direct regulator of, let's say, broadband, which is privately owned. The federal government actually kind of stays out of the way. So even though their numbers are the biggest, right, and get the most headlines in newspapers nationally and locally often, it's actually your state and community representatives who you may directly know or have a connection to that are making these big decisions.
How do we avoid boondoggles? Remember that bridge to nowhere? This, you know, goes back, feels like almost ancient history. It was a bridge in Alaska that was built, I'm assuming, with federal funds that actually wasn't used by hardly anybody. How do we avoid, you know, those kinds of traps, especially when there's the potential of so much money floating around to be spent?
I have this concern too, Maria. I got to be honest. They are the minority projects, I should stress. You know, scarcity is the mother of innovation, right? So you hear, you know, when you just heard from your PennDOT colleague, if you will, right? Hey, we're far short of the number we need. Well, that's naturally going to make sure you tend to invest in the highest demand or highest return on investment projects. But, you know, what officials inside an administration of any kind, right, anywhere, if they don't hear from the public on what they want, it's harder for them to reflect their priorities. So I tend to think the best way to avoid projects that we don't want is to make sure that an apathetic majority doesn't stay silent on the sidelines, right? And that you make your voice heard on what matters to you. What we also are seeing happen is that more and more there's a culture change inside places like PennDOT or inside Philadelphia City, where they are trying to better reach the community where they are. I'll give you this example. For planning meetings, this is like urban planning, how we design neighborhoods, oftentimes they were having community meetings at 3 o'clock p.m. Hmm. Well, I don't know about you, Mari, but I cannot make a community meeting at 3 o'clock p.m., right?
No way.
So, and we can imagine in our head who is able to make meetings at that hour, right? So that influences the voices that are heard. So for folks who want to be engaged or think about avoiding these kind of boondoggles, saying what matters most to you, it really does require getting off the sideline and making your voice heard. I know that sounds so cliche, but we don't tend to think about it in the infrastructure space. And then we turn around and say, wait, why are they building that project there versus, you know, my neighborhood needs to be repaved and I'm tired of the potholes, right? So you've got to tell people you're tired of the potholes, right? This is, I guess what I'm really saying is, everyone who's listening in the Philadelphia area and across the country, you have license to complain about infrastructure. It actually gets better things done.
Well, we're all about potholes here on Radio Times. Adi Tomer, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. He's senior fellow at Brookings Metro, and he's leading the Metropolitan Infrastructure Initiative. To replay this hour, many more hours of Radio Times, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. And you can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.